Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. In China, there are now close to 6,000 reported cases of severe acute respiratory syndrome, or SARS. More than 20,000 Chinese are under quarantine, though so far there are only about 200 reported deaths in China and another 200 in Hong Kong. Chinese authorities have taken a severe and acute drubbing over their slow response and cover-ups of a disease that they knew about 4 months before they said anything. They should have paid attention to the Little Red Book. Chairman Mao advised his officials 45 years ago that, quote, "The Communist Party does not fear criticism because we are Marxists. The truth is on our side, and the basic masses, the workers and peasants, are on our side." Well, we'll see. If the recent measures imposed to control the spread of SARS in China are successful, the new leaders may yet be able to mark their actions as swift and decisive. But if this disease takes hold in rural China, who knows what will happen? Connection listeners, how dangerous could the SARS epidemic become in China, not just for the people, but for the political health of the Chinese leaders? Could the SARS crisis become China's Chernobyl, a disaster which forces the government to become more open? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining us on the program today is Ross Terrell. Ross is a longtime student of China, Harvard research associate, and author of a new book called The New Chinese Empire. Welcome to The Connection, Ross.
Nice to be here, Dick.
And we also have with us on the line Rob Gifford, NPR's Beijing correspondent. Rob, welcome back to The Connection.
Hi there, Dick.
I need you to sort of put me in the center of this story. I think you're just looking at the city supposedly coming back to life after the long May Day weekend. What are you seeing on the streets? What are you hearing?
Well, it is coming back to life to a certain degree. Today, as you say, they cut the May Day holiday to 3 days rather than the usual 7 because they didn't want people traveling. And over the weekend and at the end of last week, it was a total ghost town. It normally takes me 45 minutes to drive to work, and it was taking me half that, 20 minutes. There was nobody on the roads. There were no pedestrians. It was a beautiful sunny weekend, and everyone, it seemed, was holed up in their apartment because they were afraid to go out. Now it's starting to move a little bit. The initial shock has perhaps worn off a little bit and a few people are coming out. The government is still saying those who can work from home should work from home. But I think what we're going to see is probably what happened in Hong Kong. We're probably about 6 weeks behind the Hong Kong curve and how there we had this initial shock and how everybody stayed off the streets. Then gradually it got back to normal. But as you mentioned in your intro, the big difference with China, of course, is that China has a hinterland. Hong Kong is a city of 7 million people. Beijing is a city of 14 million people, but there are several hundred million, 1.3 billion people out there in the rural areas and the other cities, and we just don't know what's going on with them. So that's really the big question that is facing everybody here at the moment.
Now, we see newspaper photographs of people in Beijing with paper masks on as they ride the buses. Is that what you see?
Sure, yes, that's what we see the whole time. Everybody's wearing a mask and everybody, you know, you step into an elevator. I have to say I'm not wearing a mask all the time. If I go near hospitals, if I go in very crowded places, then I do wear a mask. But getting into an elevator at work, I don't always wear a mask. And, you know, if there's people in there when I step in, there's a sort of sharp intake of breath. And who is this guy? Why isn't he wearing a mask?
So
there is a certain amount of paranoia. And while we're talking about masks, I should tell you the best story of the week, which is that China's largest underwear manufacturer that produces the most number of underpants, male underpants in the country for export, has shifted its production to make masks. And they are now doing their patriotic duty to help the effort against SARS. And so there's a lot of people walking around with reversioned underpants over their mouth and nose.
Oh, as part of that patriotic move that Rob is describing, we actually had Rob take his microphone and put it by the national television channel just a short time before we went to air, and this is what we heard.
(Laughs)
Rob, as we listen to that in the background, maybe you can tell us what's on television while this singing's going on.
Well, this is one of the many programs. There are actually a lot of Chinese TV channels now. I think there are 12 CCTV, Central Chinese Television channels, and this was just one of them, which had a sort of gala performance with a lot of singers on stage, a lot of very eager hosts talking into microphones, and behind this singer and behind the host, there was the massive slogan, "All the people with one heart fight." SARS. And that particular lady was dressed in a military uniform. She was singing not specifically about SARS, but singing about how the people of the party and the people are going to work together, and we're basically going to kick this thing. So really, the propaganda machine has moved into overdrive. I mean, you turn on the TV at any point during the day, and you will hear songs like that. It really is amazing.
Rob, I want you to stay with us for a couple of minutes if you can. I'd like to hear from Ross Terrell. Ross, that description of what's on television sounds in many ways so outdated, so, you know, from the old book, The Maoist Response.
It is a twitch of the old party state. Everything is a campaign. You know, empirical step-by-step is not their style. They're happier with either saying nothing about something or turning it into an extravaganza and saying the party loves you and the party will never take its attention off this for a moment.
Now, in the case of a disease which they don't get to control, do you think that that type of approach will work or can work? Or do you think that perhaps, as Rob's saying, if SARS gets into rural China, they may be in some significant trouble?
Well, we're all here in the hands of the medical future of the virus. I suppose there's really three levels to the issue. One is the medical level. Another is what Rob was describing, the communal psychology of it, people's perception. Then the third level is a possible political repercussions, and the last is dependent to some extent on the second, on how people react, and do they panic, because I don't think there's a direct danger politically. Communist parties do have horrendous disputes and feuds, and someone becomes a splittist or a counter-revolutionary, but I don't think a disease lends itself to this, unless, and here we go back to the first point, the medical issue, unless, as you both were speaking of, unless it does attack the hinterland of China in a big way, then you would have disorder, and then you would have kicking in another factor. The Chinese people have learned to be pretty skeptical about what they're told by officials. Mostly they let it slide off their back. Mm-hmm. And there is a pent-up distrust, which if real suffering on a massive scale took place, would have great political repercussions.
Rob, there's a story in my morning paper about a riot in Linzhou, a small city in Hunan province. I'm not sure if I've got the geography right here.
Zhejiang province.
Zhejiang province. I'm surprised by two things. First of all, that not just that the riot took place, but that it's being reported.
Right. I'm not sure that you will see that reported in the Chinese press. In fact, I'm sure that you won't. You're seeing that in the foreign press because that is happening now. That's about the third or fourth one that we have heard about. And it does show the level of panic that has been reached here. I think ordinary people, many of whom you must remember are just ordinary farmers. I mean, peasants.
And I should explain that the way this is being written, excuse me for interrupting, Rob, that apparently the cause of the riot is people in those rural cities afraid that the migrant workers from Beijing and Shanghai are going to come back and bring the disease back to their home city.
Right, right. So you have people, what has happened in a couple of places is the local government has moved to set up a disused school as a sort of quarantine area for suspected SARS patients. People who perhaps don't have a huge amount of education, they see this great mobilization of the propaganda machine of the party, and they think, wow, we don't want, it's the classic not in my backyard syndrome on a Chinese rural level. So people are scared. The Chinese media will not be reporting these things. The government is desperate not to allow this to lead to any kind of social unrest. They've got enough on their plate already. But I would, I think I agree with Ross that it's not necessarily going to lead to some great political meltdown. What it will do, though, is possibly add a couple of hundred million discontented people to the hundreds of millions that there already are. And, that's a sort of a cumulative effect that when the next spark comes, could all blow up somewhere down the line.
But I was struck by one voice I heard in a piece that you filed where, and I'm thinking now of the comparison between Tiananmen Square and the SARS virus, because, Tiananmen was in one way sort of a political thing brought upon the students themselves by their irresponsible behavior. And the voice of the person that you had in your story was saying, wow, my government lied to me.
Right. Over SARS or over Tiananmen?
Over SARS, yes.
Right.
The response was actually more outrage over SARS than reflecting back over Tiananmen.
Well, and I think that reflects a very important issue here. Of course, in the West, we looked at Tiananmen and we thought, wow, that's incredible that that's happening. But the people who led that were the students, were the intellectuals. And what you're seeing now, not just with SARS, but certainly with SARS, is ordinary people who are not that well educated. They're not thinking in terms of, political science paradigms. They're not thinking even about democracy particularly. They're thinking about how this affects their daily health, the health of their children, whether they can earn money in the future. Same with all so many of the other complaints now. They are less political in nature initially, but they take on a sort of political significance as they get going.
Does that make them riskier then, Ross, for the government?
In one sense, yes, Dick. Health is intensely personal. Every person knows what that mask means when they see it. You don't have to have a university degree. You can be totally illiterate. And yet health is also startlingly global, as China's neighbors had to tell them 2 weeks ago at the meeting in Bangkok. So potentially, again, depending on the course of the virus, potentially every Chinese in a place where the virus is in the air is at risk, and potentially, alas, due to air travel and trains rushing all over China, the thing can spread and it becomes an international issue.
All right. Well, we'll pick that up when we come back after the break. Rob Gifford, thanks a lot for your help on the program today.
Thanks, Dick.
Rob Gifford is NPR's correspondent based in Beijing. Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We're looking at the health and the political ramifications of what we know and what we don't know about the SARS epidemic in China this hour. 1-800-423-TALK to join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Certainly the SARS virus is not going away, as some people would have wished by this time. In particular, the nation worth watching is the nation that brought the disease, a place where it is thought to have started, China. And the response of the leaders there, committed now but too late, or thorough enough? These are some of the questions that we'll be looking at this hour. How dangerous could that epidemic become in China, not just for the people, but also politically for the stability of the country? I have with me on the program today Ross Terrell. He's a research associate at the Fairbanks Center for East Asian Research at Harvard University. He's author of a biography of Mao, which sold some 1.4 million copies inside China, and is a longtime observer and student of that country. We're joined also now from the University of Chicago by Dali Yang, who's an associate professor of political science there and author of Beyond Beijing, Liberalization and the Regions of China. And Dali, you're just back from, 2 weeks ago from a research trip to China, is that right?
Yes, indeed. I was in Beijing and Tianjin.
And so that's long enough for you to know that you don't have a high fever or difficulty breathing.
Actually, I came back on the 13th of April, so it's well past my period of quarantine.
Were you worried?
A little bit, but actually not that much. I took all the precautions that I could. But the issue at that time before I left was the level of uncertainty, because the government was not letting people know at that time what was the rate of infections in Beijing in particular, because we did know what's going on, generally speaking, in Guangdong by that time, but not in Beijing. So there was quite a bit of concern among the general populace. And there were a lot of rumors, and which mostly actually have turned out to be true, of how hospitals were treating many more patients than the government had let people know. So in that sense, that's one of the factors that contributed to my return. But shortly after I returned to Chicago, the Chinese health minister, as well as the mayor of Beijing, was sacked, and they have become far more open, certainly about Beijing.
And do you think that the rest of the world is getting the straight goods now on what's happening in China, or do you think that there are still low-level officials who are keeping these figures under the radar, if you know what I mean?
I think generally speaking, actually, they are as accurate as they can be under the circumstances, because there is no genuinely acceptable, I mean, everybody accepts, there's no one standard for actually judging or evaluating a patient at this moment. So there are cases that are initially that were judged to be a SARS, that were later ruled out and then were ruled in again. Mm-hmm. And this has happened actually quite a few times in Beijing and also in other parts of the country. So there are problems for diagnosing the disease at this moment that makes it very uncertain. But in the meantime, though, there are incentives, very strong incentives for local officials to report the truth, so to speak. First of all, the Beijing authorities have actually basically said, if you don't report actually on the numbers, indeed on suspected numbers, then local officials can be fired. And so far, there have been actually more than 50 local officials, including hospital directors and others, who have been fired nationwide for mishandling the disease. Secondly, actually, the central government is pouring a lot of money into dealing with this crisis. So if you actually have a few patients, you are more likely to get more funds. And so there are monetary incentives for reporting the truth and, in fact, in going ahead and getting the help that you can get from the central government.
Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. This hour we're talking about SARS, specifically in China, with a look at how dangerous it is, not just for the health of the people in that country, but also for the rest of the region if the disease is unchecked, and what some of the political ramifications might be for the new communist leadership there. And Ross Terrell, maybe I can turn to you on that point, because every new set of leaders in China has to prove itself somehow. And it's not clear to me at this point whether or not the long delay is what will mark President Hu Jintao or the response that came then after that delay.
Well, let me put that in the context of the Chinese state. I've called this new book The New Chinese Empire, not just because they control Tibet and part of Mongolia and a Turkic people in the West, not just because they want further territories, Taiwan, islands in the East and South China Seas, part of Siberia, the Soviet Far East. But for a third reason, which goes to the heart of this morning's discussion, the state is still a partly imperial state. What do I mean by that? It's a project from above, and it considers that truth as well as power ultimately emanate from the party state. There's no alternative source of a worldview of what I call truth available. The Falun Gong Buddhists discovered that. They're not political people, but the party state saw them as such because it saw someone who had another worldview. So this puts them in a very peculiar situation in reacting to medical facts. The medical profession, like the journalistic profession or the accounting profession in China, is not autonomous. It is subject to this pressure that the party state is the fount of truth. So at the start in southern China, the party state said to the journalists, identify this as the bacteria chlamydia. Now, that's a known virus in the West. That would have located it as something that didn't start in China. It was the same response, which I remember very well, to that of AIDS. Understate the cases, blame non-Chinese where possible, and give as little information as you can. Now, they've been forced, and Dali has given examples, they've been forced to be quite open in the last 2 or 3 weeks. This is a dictatorship, but it's a rational one. And actually, in Tiananmen, which you mentioned before, they also bent over backwards. They had a dialogue with the students where they allowed the students to rebuke them. And Li Peng, the premier at the time, got very, very angry. So they will do a great deal to protect their power.
Something's changing, and that is that the people aren't necessarily as willing or eager or, I'm not sure if the word unsophisticated is the right way to describe it, as they were back in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s. Dali, when the state presents this monolithic view of any one particular issue, how critical are the people behind the sort of safety or comfort of their own home front doors?
I think, first of all, this is a very brave new world for the Chinese leadership, in fact, because of the Internet, because of the availability of other sources of information, essentially. Because China currently not only has a very large Internet population now, but also has the largest number of telecom subscribers. That makes it much easier to pass information around. Ross was mentioning how, in fact, the central government was actually, the Guangdong authorities were, or the party was actually forcing one interpretation of the disease. In fact, that was what happened within the Chinese version of the CDC. The Guangdong doctors knew, however, that the treatments that they were administering for chlamydia-related diseases was not working, so they had to try something else. And in fact, one of the leading Guangdong doctors was the one, a technician in this case, but who believed that his ultimate political commitment is to treat the disease well, essentially was one of the advocates in saying that actually that doesn't work and that the disease is not under control. So there are people who are willing to speak, and then you combine that with a worldwide information network, and that information gets to spread around, and which eventually actually makes it very difficult to control the flow of information. And secondly, the leadership actually is not as easily manipulated as before. So both President Hu Jintao and Premier Wen Jiabao themselves are actually Internet users who go on the Internet to check on the attitudes of the students, the general web-based population, as well as for news from the outside. So they actually can gauge the situation better than before in terms of not being controlled by the bureaucracy per se. So that's actually makes it a very interesting combination now than before.
Connection listeners, 1-800-423-8255. A chance for you to get in on a conversation about the implications of the SARS virus in China, what it might mean for the new leaders there, what it might mean just for the overall health of the country. Certainly one of the impacts that will cause trouble for these leaders is economic. At a time when the Communist Party, Ross, has refused to allow any sort of political freedom, people have swallowed that pill because there was money to be made in that country. And if the SARS epidemic starts to chip away at that, will that be trouble for this new empire?
Well, you're absolutely right. And I think Dali is right, too, in saying that the leaders are in a brave new world. It's a risky world, and the fundamental reason for it is this. The collapse of the Soviet Union was a tremendous shock to China as well. It might be the legitimating base of the Chinese Revolution was the Bolshevik Revolution. But Deng Xiaoping was very clever in his response to the fall of the Soviet Union. The instinct of the left wing of the Communist Party at the time was different from Deng's. It was Western spiritual pollution has infiltrated Moscow and Poland, and the imperialists are ultimately to blame. The old story. Mm-hmm. And Deng retreated, and 3 months later, he came out with a completely different line. He went to South China, the heart of the commercialization. He gave a green light to stock exchanges. He said the enemy in China is not the right. The students at Tiananmen had been called rightists. He said the enemy is the left. Basically, Deng was saying, we're going to save Leninism with consumerism. The mistake of the Soviet leaders was to put political reform first, but not to deliver the economic goods to the Soviet people.
And it's been working.
It's been working. For 12 years, Leninism plus consumerism, if you'll excuse a rather simple summation of it, has been the tacit pact between people and party state. Fine, get rich, don't worry about communist doctrine, but no challenge, please, to the Communist Party's monopoly of power.
All right, now, Dali, your area of expertise is rural China, and when people wag a finger of doom at the circumstances that Ross has just described, they say it'll be fine for all the people in Shanghai and Beijing who are getting rich at these times, but the revolt, the anger, if and when it comes, will come from rural China, the people who are left behind. And I'm wondering what risk you see at this point of that kind of uprising or anger coming in response to a spread of the disease.
I think, first of all, even before the current leadership actually came into their formal positions, there was consensus that the rural issues are going to be on the top of the agenda. And indeed, they were put on the top of the agenda even before SARS came to the fore. And one of the issues actually is the lack of healthcare in rural areas, not to mention other social services. And in the meantime, though, combining the lack of sort of adequate health care with the stagnation in rural incomes, those are the kind of issues that have caused a lot of concern among the top elite. And now with the disease, the fear, first of all, is that it may not be able to be controlled if the disease spreads into the rural areas where actually there are inadequate health facilities. It's very it's reasonably going to be possible to control the disease in Beijing or Tianjin or Hebei, for that matter. But once it gets to really spread in Shanxi or Inner Mongolia, not to mention further west, then it may be extraordinarily difficult to do so. Indeed, already in Shanxi, which is actually a province adjacent to Beijing, the medical professionals have trouble tracing the the chance of transmission already. At this moment, though, I mean, the main risk is actually medical in the sense of how to control this. And if not, whether parts of the rural areas actually will simply be quarantined off to the tremendous detriment to their local economies. But down the road, of course, that raises issues of protest. Already you see some riots locally in Henan, in Zhejiang, in Tianjin, because of isolation facilities being situated in some villages or near villages where the villagers actually were not told beforehand that those were happening, and they were afraid of what's going on. So fear is actually taking hold in many of those rural communities, and also localized riots. But over the long run, though, actually, the economic stagnation that's going to be caused by the spread of SARS actually will increase unemployment, which actually will be actually sort of contributing to the kind of social unrest. But
in rural China. You're listening to The Connection China. From National Public Radio. Let's take our first call now from Cary, North Carolina. Jan's on the line. Hi, Jan.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
Hello, Jan.
Hi. I lived in Beijing for 4.5 years. Excuse the background noise. I'm on my morning walk. I have 2 teenage children living there right now, and I feel it's not a good time to go visit them in Beijing. I'm more concerned about quarantine than the actual disease.
What are they saying about the way that the SARS epidemic has affected them?
They are bored stiff because they're stuck at home.
They're students, are they?
One is teaching English over there, and one is a student. And they're living with my ex-husband, their dad. And they have nothing to do, which is good for me because that means we chat on the Internet more often.
Well, Jan, my advice would be being bored stiff is better than getting SARS. Tell them to stick to the quarantine. And if I were you, I wouldn't go to Beijing at the moment and see them.
Do you think that the ability of the Beijing authorities to keep the buses clean, to control the virus, as Dali was saying, can be done in that city? I mean, they're talking about 30,000 inspectors on the street in that city today alone. What do you think, Russ?
Sorry, Jan has gone?
Yeah.
Once more, Dick, if you don't mind.
No, just whether or not they can actually control the disease in Beijing with all their inspectors on the street.
Well, look, hopefully this virus isn't as deadly as many other diseases in the world. Again, we're in the hands of the medical future of this virus, and I'm not a medical worker. And hopefully the China's neighbors will quickly recover from their annoyance at how China handled it. But what China's doing now is the right thing to do, and they're quite good at this. When they decide to be tough, and as Dali said before, economic incentives to tell the truth, they can be effective.
1-800-423-8255 is the number to join our conversation today about the SARS virus and its spread in China. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, and we're talking about the spread of the SARS virus in China and what the implications could be for people in that country, not just in health terms, although that comes first, but also in political terms, whether or not the response of the government has been fast enough and persuasive enough for the people in that country. 1-800-423-8255. With me on the program today, Dali Yang. He's an associate professor of political science at the University of Chicago and author most recently of Beyond Beijing, Liberalization in the Regions of China. Ross Terrell is with me here in the Boston studio. His new book's called The New Chinese Empire and What It Means for the United States. He's a research associate at Harvard University. And we're going to go straight to Dali. Let me start with you if I can, because the questions one of the questions that I began with at the beginning of the program was whether or not it is even appropriate to talk about the SARS virus as possibly China's Chernobyl, as the event which forces a degree of openness on a government which, you know, historically balks at any of that. Do you think that's going too far?
Yeah, I think actually there are interesting parallels here. Before I go there, actually, first of all, let me mention I do have a new book coming out called Remaking the Chinese Leviathan, which is about remaking how the Chinese state is being remade in various different aspects, which touches on some of the issues we deal with here. In terms of comparing ourselves with Chernobyl, first of all, at the time of Chernobyl, the Soviet Union was certainly not reformed either economically or politically, whereas China today is much more open, much more commercially free than the Soviet Union ever was, and there is actually a lot of information. In fact, even before SARS, the Chinese governments, actually local governments in particular, have been quite open in terms of sources of information in most areas of the economic development. If you go today to any website sort of hosted by a local Chinese government, it can do a lot of things, getting information, filing complaints, trying to get a license or something like that, or even pay taxes. So there is actually already a lot of interaction between the state and business actually in that area. It's certain other areas that actually have lagged behind: healthcare, education reforms, the social services sector in general have lagged behind.
Okay, but we're talking. You're talking about a degree of commercial openness, and this is a party that, as Ross was saying earlier in the program, has, through the force of its will, been able to maintain a that one party state, and certainly Ross, part of that has got to come from the desire to control information.
Dali's talking about intellectuals and an elite, really. Most Chinese people, and remember, we're talking about rural people, they don't get their information from the internet, period. And we saw this in a couple of crises with the United States not that long ago, 1999, when NATO mistakenly bombed the Chinese embassy in Belgrade. President Clinton apologized, NATO apologized. Chinese people for 3 or 4 days were told nothing of that apology, and they thought we had done it deliberately. And there were huge demonstrations. American butchers go home. This is only 4 years ago. Then, 4 days later, the Chinese government, actually Hu Jintao, who's now moved into the presidency, he made a broadcast. He referred to Clinton's apology, and the demonstrations stopped. That proved that the Chinese government turned information on and off like a hose. In 2001, 2 years later, there was the airplane crash between an American surveillance plane and a Chinese fighter near Hainan.
The fighter went down and the surveillance plane was forced
exactly. The surveillance plane was lucky, an EP-3, and it limped into an airport and the Chinese held it for some time. This was a tremendous brouhaha, and all the stuff about us being imperialists and hegemonists, you know, it was full throttle. And the information given to the Chinese people in both of these cases makes me very sympathetic with the people's reaction. They simply weren't told more than one side of Kosovo, and they weren't told substantial facts about the airplane collision. So this is still a state that can control information when it wants to. It's a brave new world. Every time there's pressure on the state, and there is pressure on the state, as Dali Young has said, but they have no intention of generalizing this openness to everything that comes up. Let's say religion. I mean, why are they so afraid of religious people if they want openness?
All right, let's go back to our phone lines if we can. 1-800-423-8255 to Diane, who's calling us from the highway, I-95, near Wilson, North Carolina. Hi, Diane.
Hey there.
Hello, Diane.
Hi.
Hello. I'm enjoying your conversation. I have a question, though. I'm a PhD physiologist, and I certainly have taught a lot about disease in the last 20 years as a university faculty member. My question, and I don't think that China is going to control this, and it's going to end up in, say, 3 or 4 months, with the rest of the world basically quarantining all of China. And I'd like to know the implications of that.
You mean the economic implications or the political implications, Diane?
Both. You can't separate them.
No, I suppose you can under the circumstances. Dali, why don't you take the first swing at that one, and then I'll turn to Ross here in the studio.
Well, certainly there have been people predicting that, and that would be the worst-case scenario. But my sense is that's unlikely to happen because the urban areas, particularly coastal China, will largely free itself of this. And in the meantime, though, trade continues to flow because the virus does generally, actually, with proper quarantine and disinfection, the goods continue to flow, although services are going to be actually sort of restrained.
Right, but what Diane's doing, though, Dali, is looking ahead a few weeks and kind of predicting. We hear today that the Motorola factory, cell phone factory in Beijing has been closed because there was one case there. If it's not contained, if it spreads, what will the economic and political implications of this be?
I think in that particular case, that would be the worst case scenario. China will be quarantined, essentially, and there will be very serious repercussions in terms of the economy and employment and leading to political reclamations within the Chinese leadership.
It's a big if that Diane raises, and I don't think we should jump to that. The history in these other places, Singapore, for example, suggests that rational measures can do a lot. But if it happened, China is tinder dry. I happen to say at the end of this new book, The New Chinese Empire, China would be a juicy target for any new pandemic. I wrote that 6 months ago. The reason for that is the situation in rural healthcare that Dali Young mentioned, and also the lack of transparency and the building up of a kind of distrust at the government turning information on and off. But it would have to interact, Diane, with other things. We've mentioned rural problems and unemployment in the cities. Astonishingly, there's no connection yet between these two things.
Go ahead, Diane.
I'm sorry, but Singapore and China are very different when you try to compare those two.
True.
Or even Hong Kong. And the major difference is that China did not basically quarantine Beijing before all of the workers left and became potential vectors into the small areas of China where there really is no health care.
That's true.
That's my concern.
There's another...
Yeah, that was a major mistake that was made. In fact, it's the central government in China sent inspectors into the provinces. They quickly found out that a lot of people live in Beijing, so they put that information back to the center, and the center essentially made tremendous efforts to get Beijing to keep most people within the city. But the box was opened, though.
All right, Diane, thanks for that call. Let's go to Providence, Rhode Island now. Carol's with us. Hi, Carol.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
Great show, as always. My sister right now is in Xinjiang in western China. Pakistan and Kazakhstan have closed their borders.
Does she live there? Is she traveling there?
She has been teaching English in China. She was in a different province, more central to China, for a while, teaching English. Now she's in Xinjiang. And she can't get out because Pakistan and Kazakhstan have closed their borders. My question is, they've been symptom-free for 20 days. Why? I don't understand why, you know, if the CDC were to send someone there if they couldn't, you know, certify people at the border as healthy.
I don't think there's going to be, necessarily smart, rational responses anywhere around the world while all the question marks are in the air. I saw also in the paper today that the University of California at Berkeley has banned some 500 summer students from China, from Taiwan, from Hong Kong, from Singapore, saying that they don't even want to go to the trouble of trying to set up that kind of quarantine. Ross, I interrupted your response.
Well,
Carol's
point is very interesting because it's the intersection between the disease's repercussions and underlying problems that we have to look at if the thing keeps going on and on.
Which underlying problems meaning what?
Well, I mentioned the rural issues linking up with urban issues. And now Carol's raised another one, the non-Chinese peoples. The province where her daughter is, Xinjiang, is...
Sister,
is the home of the Uyghur Muslim people. It's a huge province. It's got borders itself with seven countries, two of which Carol mentioned. Mm-hmm. Then the disease has hit Inner Mongolia, a province of China that's the southern part of what in the north is a separate country of Mongolia. And to the southwest is Tibet. Now, in these places, there's an underlying problem that Han Chinese and the Tibetans, Uyghurs and Mongols are uneasy with each other for various reasons. At an extreme, the non-Chinese people would like to be a separate country. Less extreme, they just feel condescended to. Now, if SARS hit these places, that's tinder dry, not in just a public health sense, but it's tinder dry all the emotions that people would have against Beijing for reasons that
that are
colonialism,
already there. Waiting to be stoked. So, Carol, you're in touch with your sister on a regular basis?
Well, by email. And the thing is, you know, she is confirming exactly what you are saying, which is that people out there aren't getting any information from the government. She gets her information from the internet because she's savvy about these things, but the people around her that she speaks to don't know anything and feel pretty angry. You know?
Well, is it fear or is it anger at the government? How does she interpret that?
I think it's both, you know. I think those both are longstanding in the area.
Well, send her our best wishes, and I hope she stays well and gets out soon.
Okay, thanks.
Carol, thanks for your call. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. Dali, I guess it'll be probably sometime in the next 2-3 weeks when we start to get an idea of just how well contained the disease is.
Certainly, at this moment, the trend in Beijing has been actually the new cases are coming down, the number of new cases every day. And, of course, it's hard to extrapolate from the data series from just a few days' time. But by looking at what happened in Guangdong, though, one is hopeful that Beijing would be able to contain it. And then there are medical personnel will likely be dispatched from Guangdong and from other parts of the country to help with some of the interior provinces as well. So we are going to see a chain reaction as new cases are discovered in other parts of the country, as nationally this command center will help actually redistribute resources. So it's going to be a long struggle, but in the meantime, though, we are already seeing successes. Guangdong, for example, has had almost 1,500 cases, but only 200 actually are in hospital as SARS cases now. More than 1,000 has already left hospitals.
All right, Dali, thanks for being with us on the program today.
You're most welcome.
Nice to talk with you, Dali.
Dali Yang is Associate Professor at the University of Chicago, author of Beyond Beijing, Liberalization in the Regions of China. Ross Terrell, thanks a lot for coming in.
My pleasure, Dick.
Ross is author of many books on China, most recently The New Chinese Empire, out just this year. Earlier in the program, we talked with our own NPR correspondent, Rob Gifford, who is based in Beijing. Connection listeners, you can continue the conversation online at our website. We're at theconnection.org. And you can find there a website to the WHO, which will give you the latest information on where the cases are being reported. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.